was a split second I thought this bottle was going to like clock me in the face, because it kind of took it so hard, and it was so well received, but avoided that near miss. And 9 times out of 10 you go for a bottle at that speed, it's just going to fly off into the air or whatever. So Johnny might have a future career in the Swanee life.
Welcome back to the Placeholders Podcast, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. It's Wednesday, May 24th. And joining me today, straight off the Ross, Ronan McLaughlin, how are you? How do the legs feel?
The legs are recovering. I'm not actually straight off the Ross because I'm sitting here in Dublin Airport.
I think that's true. I exaggerated there a little bit.
Yeah.
You've been to Campagnolo. I'm in Dublin since Airport. Then.
Can you say that?
We're not going to say why.
That might be embargoed information there.
I don't think so.
But yeah, I'm sitting in Dublin Airport on the return journey from Italy. I've just realized why they call it Dublin. Cafe Nero have made that very clear to me. I just ordered a coffee here from Cafe Nero, and the claim that they have up here in a big poster and on the back of everybody's t-shirts is the best espresso this side of Milan, and while I highly refute that claim, I don't believe it to be true and whatsoever. I think it's actually false advertising, because what I've just consumed wasn't even the best coffee this side of the toilet here, but what was worse was the €9.50 that I paid for a flat white and a slice of cake. And actually forgot to get the receipt, I'm just realizing, so I can't even claim it back. But it's clearly that everything here is doubling in price, or Dublin price, the rest of the country. So that's now, I understand why it's called Dublin.
Opening with a pun. I always appreciate that. Also joining
Long
us
winded
today,
one,
Johnny,
but we got there eventually.
Johnny Long, how are you?
Good, thanks. I've got no puns and no embargoes. So it's just regular me. Ready to
just
pod.
Just regular Johnny. Ready to pod. We got a fair amount to talk about today. We are going to...
I will say, Johnny, you've got a bit of Freddie Mercury looking on there with your new mic stand. It's like the stand that you hold. It doesn't really stand itself. It's like a mic on a stick. It's like predates the selfie stick. It's a mic stick.
It's... I
haven't seen you use it before.
It's usually because I'm at a desk, but... I'm sitting on a sofa currently and the podcast stand is resting on my stomach. So maybe I'll be more laid back this podcast and less easily riled up, but we'll see what the topics are today.
We got some good topics. Like I said, we're gonna talk Ross. We're going to wrap up our Rosscast here because, you know, pretty fantastic week last week for the Foyle Cycling Club. One of the... Ireland's premier cycling clubs. And we also have a fair amount to talk about from the Giro and about Mark Cavendish, because Mark Cavendish has just announced that he will be retiring at the end of this year. So we're going to get into Cav, you know, a bit of legacy stuff, what it means for this year. And, well, at the Giro, we finally had some GC action. Actually, first real sort of uphill finish GC action of the entire race thus far, and we are on, it happened on stage 16, so it took us a while to get here, but we're going to talk about what all that means, who's left at the Giro, and how much we love Joao Almeida, basically. Let's start off with the biggest story of the week, which is the Foyle Cycling Club, and how well your boys did last week, Ronan. Update the listeners on where you all ended up. How? Give me the highlights.
Your men ended up taking home the county team overall prize at the end of the Ross. There, we had, you know, the guys that we met in the podcast last week, Finn Crockett, Joe Laverick, up there fighting for stage ones and overall honors. And Finn was getting closer and closer throughout the week. He started off, he had missed a split on the first stage, so didn't really place there, but then had seventh on the next, fourth on the following stage, third, second, and then finally topped it off with winning the final stage of the Ross in Blackrock there on Sunday, which Yeah, capped a pretty amazing week for the club, having entered the first team in the Ross, and first time in the club's 20-year history and the Ross's 70-year history. And then we also had Sean Ogue, the sort of baby amongst us on the team, finished his first Ross, and between the four of us, placing three of us up on every stage, we took home the team classification. Unfortunately, along the way, we lost Conor Dooney to a concussion following a crash mid-stage three. But apart from that slight sort of blemish in an otherwise perfect week, I don't think it could have went much better. We should mention as well that Dylan Corkery of the Irish national team actually won the Ross overall, took the overall honours, having won the penultimate stage and then made it with Finn into the break on the last stage, and gaining enough time there to unfortunately jump our own Joe Laverick on GC, but yeah, good to see Irish national team taking a win in the Ross.
Johnny, how was the rest of your week? Bottle hand-ups went well, driving around quickly and back roads all went well.
I will say Johnny has the type of bottle hand-up I've never experienced before. We came through one feed zone. I think it was on the third stage. We averaged something like 48.5, 49 kilometers per hour for that stage. We came through the speed zone. I think we were actually time traveling. We were going that fast at the time. And I went for a bottle more so in hope with no real expectation of getting it. But Johnny literally like implanted the bottle in my hand. It was like it was like an explosion going off. The noise when I got the bottle, and really, I've never had a bottle so forcefully delivered, but so accurately and well delivered at the same time. It was perfect.
So this is a positive. And I was expecting you to give me a nightmare story here, but no, he did an excellent work.
There was a split second, right? Like more so due to the speed that the peloton was moving. That there was a split second I thought this bottle was going to like clock me in the face. Because it kind of took it so hard, and it was so well received, but avoided that near miss. And yeah, nine times out of ten, you go for a bottle at that speed, it's just going to fly off into the air or whatever. So no, it was Johnny might have a future career in the Swanee life.
I was just making sure you got that bottle, Ronan. As much as I enjoyed handing out bottles, and generally just enjoyed being at a bike race where I was like invested in it. That was the biggest thing, was I wasn't there as like media where you're only really caring about it being interesting. Being a Swanier fell apart the very next day after the good bottle, when I was going the wrong way on the course, and instead of being on the top of the climb, ended up on the descent. And it'd been such a faff to get there that I was like, well, I'm still going to try and give out a bottle, because maybe they really need one and they'll like break. You know, you never know. You might as well just stand by the side of the road. So I stood the only person there on the side of the road on the descent with the bottle like stuck out, and everyone just was going past, just looking at me like, what are you doing? So I enjoyed it, but I think my day job is safe for now.
I think the big take home from the week for you, Johnny, was the Irish deli service stations.
Yes, at the service station. So we don't have this in Britain. But in Ireland, you go into most sort of petrol stations and they will have a very elaborate hot food counter where you can get your like breakfast rolls and whatever, like sausage, bacon, egg. But they also do hot chicken rolls, and there's just like a whole salad bar of stuff you put in with your hot chicken, a variety of sauces. Like we were in like the deepest, darkest countryside of Ireland, and they had like Korean barbecue sauce for your hot chicken roll. It was just amazing and confusing. The very last one I went into on the final stage, it had full rotisserie chickens rotating on like a spit either side of like the vapes and the cigarettes. It was just like you walked in and like all the green pastures were gone, and it was just like a cornucopia of endless possibilities. It wasn't my main takeaway from the week, but it was the thing that I had least expected. That was my Movistar's Irish least expected day, was that the service stations are all unreal.
I mean, I think that somebody who's covered the Tour de France a number of times, Johnny, you have another country to compare to, significantly improved on the sort of the French roadside cuisine.
Yeah, and also even the coffee that comes out of a machine is just so much better than any Senseo or French Starbucks or anything. Like, I don't know how they did it. And also, everyone in Ireland is still so unbelievably polite. Like, sort of Western postmodernism hasn't really reached certain pockets. So everyone is just nice to you and helpful. And I say this in a way, in a positive way. Like, everywhere we went just felt like a big village. Because everyone's sort of just like, there's no like wariness of strangers or people don't know. It's just friendliness. And that was really useful when I was driving around back roads getting lost.
It's kind of the opposite. Like, if you don't know someone, if someone is a stranger, then that's the person you wave to, as if you do know them.
Yeah, it was great.
That's how you work in Ireland. You almost do yourself an injury, the amount of waving you have to do driving country roads in Ireland.
I feel like the Irish Tourism Board should be paying us for this episode.
I hadn't realized, Johnny had mentioned this, the deli counters in our service stations, and I hadn't, I guess growing up with it, it didn't seem all that interesting, but it wasn't until you mentioned like the Tour de France petrol station stop where you grab a soggy sandwich in a plastic bag and a Senseo coffee that I realized, oh yeah, we actually do have decent delis. And I think they actually stem from, they've always been a bit of a thing since the turn of the century there, but it really took off. There was a song about a decade and a half ago by a comedian in Ireland, the Jumbo Breakfast Roll, and that was sort of the shot of adrenaline that the Irish deli counter needed. Basically, a jumbo breakfast roll is two eggs, two rashers, two sausage, two bacon, two puddings, one black, one white, all placed in like a tower on top of each other and then wrapped up good and tight. So it's basically like a fried breakfast inside a baguette, and that's where it sort of stemmed from. But yeah, the guys were just kind of in shock about how good our service stations were. To which I was sort of, I won't lie, I was a little bit disappointed. Given how friendly we are as a nation, given our tremendous scenery, given the crack, given the Guinness, given everything, you think about other countries like Belgium, you've got chocolate, you've got beer, you've got bakeries. Think about French cuisine, Italian pasta and all that. And then Johnny comes to Ireland and he's like, I love your sandwiches from the petrol station. It was like the big take-home thing. I was a little disappointed.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's something to be proud of, incredibly proud of. Because if that's the lowest common denominator, it can only go up from there, right? Like, if that's the baseline.
I don't know. Is it like we do also have like a, as a nation, extremely high cholesterol levels, and I dare say the jumbo breakfast rolls have a bit of a problem, a role to play in that problem.
So that fellow that sang that song has something to answer for. Unfortunately, it actually sounds quite similar. Johnny, have you covered a Giro before?
No, but I've done some one-day races, so I've been to some of the.
Yeah, so covering a Giro, like, one of the reasons I always love covering the Giro versus the Tour de France: one, you can get dinner after 8 p.m., which is nice, and two, similar thing where the sort of like the petrol station, the gas station stops, are often these big. Like amazing sort of counters where you can get like mozzarella and you can get like good pizza and good coffee and all the rest. And it really does change your view of a country when you're traveling through it, that you can stop and get quality goods like that.
Have we got a second for me to tell my 2 a.m. Italian service station story from just two nights ago?
That's when my flight was. It's what this podcast is for. So go on.
So my flight to Venice, not to Campag, my flight to Venice was severely delayed, and I ended up landing very, very late after midnight. And the Italian taxi driver, who didn't speak any English, but actually seemingly secretly spoke English, he forgot himself a few times and broke into English, and then realized that he was speaking English and changed back to Italian so that I couldn't understand him. But, I mean, at least he would shout at me louder when he was speaking in Italian, which didn't really help, but it's kind of a dumb thing. Anyway, he asked me at one point, did I want a coffee? To which I started not really wanting to get bogged down in the language problem again. I just said yes. What I actually wanted was just something to eat. So stopped at a service station. I ran down to the loo's to use the toilet very quickly. Came back up, and he had already ordered and paid for my coffee, which was nice of him. But it was 2 a.m. in the morning. I had just finished a 5-day stage race. I wanted to get to sleep as soon as we got to the hotel. So I tried to intervene to stop the coffee from happening. That didn't really happen. The barista asked me, I did the motions of wanting to go to sleep and being wide awake from coffee because he had offered me a double espresso. So the barista offered to change my coffee to a decaf or a deca, which I took to mean decaf. And that seemed fine. So I actually got some food, bought that, edit, got my coffee delivered, and I'm pretty sure that the barista either just was taking the piss out of me and didn't actually give me a decaf, or mixed up and give the driver the decaf and give me the full strength, because I got to the hotel and couldn't sleep for another 2 hours and then was up at 7 a.m. for a nice new product lunch. So, but to your point, the buffalo mozzarella and Serrano ham or whatever it was sandwich that I got at 2 a.m. in an Italian service station was phenomenal.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. And it really, like I said, it changes your whole view of a country when you're traveling around, particularly by car, by highway. And you can just stop and get good food anywhere. As an American, we don't have that anywhere. I took a little road trip over the weekend and yeah, limited. Maybe some chips, the crisps version, not the English chips. Yeah, just terrible.
Did you get
bags
a big
of things?
Did you get a big gulp of root beer?
Could get a big gulp if I wanted to. Yeah, big gulp and you know, some beef jerky and whatever you can get out of a plastic bag, basically.
I want to derail our cuisine conversation here for a second. One of the airport staff has just sat down beside me and he thinks we're recording a food podcast. So I want to go back to the Ross for a second.
Yeah.
And just so he knows that it's actually a cycling podcast we're recording. And you know, we sort of touched on last week what's so special about the Ross. And I guess my question is, Johnny, have you, you know, in the 5 days since then, have you sort of grasped what it means to us, and can you communicate better than maybe I did last week? And also, I just want to point out the amount of messages that I've got from, you know, through Instagram and that, from other people who aren't Irish, but, you know, race bikes and that, who would love to do the Ross sometime. And even from the likes of Joe Laverick now, has done it and is immediately talking about next year. Like, before this year had even finished, he's talking about next year. It's got that sort of grip on riders, and for whatever reason, like it seems to be that if a racing cyclist knows of the Ross, they want to do it. So yeah, Johnny, what's your take on it now after a few days?
What was great about the Ross is that compared to like other, we go to a lot of very serious bike races, and although this bike race was raced very seriously, and we saw on the final stage a lot of high emotions between like the winners and then the people who didn't win. Was that despite that, every morning and after every stage, it was all smiles, and it was also at the same time like a participation event, not to say that in like a positive light, where it was about doing it rather than just about winning. And maybe that's just because our team got on so well, but I feel like with every team there, it was that sort of camaraderie of this race where you could feel the history and like the people who worked there. That was actually the main thing, was that you could see the time put in by people who were doing it on a completely voluntary basis, and people who had been like fixtures there for years, and where this actually meant a huge deal to them. Regardless, it wasn't about the money or the TV rights or anything like that. It was maybe one of the closest views I've had of bike racing that isn't just about like the top tier professional teams trying to win. It was also great on the final stage run, seeing what it meant to you, not only to finish like your final. Well, we'll put final in quote marks because everyone keeps on doing that with you.
I don't believe it for a second.
But but also with the win for Finn, because you know he's a guy who's like trying to make his way up the ladder, and he'd got so close, and to see his excitement of winning a stage, and then your excitement as well for that victory and to win the team prize. It was very moving. I'd say it's probably the most I've been moved at a bike race. Is that given a good view?
I think so, yeah. I don't know if you noticed, and I don't know if it's just because I know everybody at the Ross, and maybe all the races are the same for the community involved, but there seems to be like this real I think participation is the right word. Participation and community aspect to the Ross, where everybody knows everybody. Yes, the racing is incredibly serious, but there's as much prestige in, you know, in quotation marks here again, becoming a man of the Ross, as there is becoming the winner of the Ross. And it's like when you hit the finish line, after that, then it's like before the start and after the finish line, there's just this whole community atmosphere about it that brings everybody back year after year. So it's a, you know, there's as much emphasis on having the crack and having a pint of Guinness at night as there is, you know, taking the racing as seriously as it is. And I think that's why it's lasted so long, is because it's the same faces who you see volunteering year in, year out. Yes, there is new faces that join them, but it's those volunteers are getting together to catch up on everything that happened over the past year. And then you have the riders who, you know, more often than not are, you know, repeat visitors to the Ross also. And it's that engagement that they get. And it's literally, it's like, it's almost like some sort of annual get together, which happens to have a bike race in the middle of it, more so than just being a bike race. And I've certainly never seen that at any other bike race, but as I said, maybe that's just because I don't know the people at other bike races.
No, you just see that, like, everyone was like coming up and chatting. And I think actually it was in the some of it was like the smaller details, like the guy who was doing the announcing the podium each day was just like sort of cracking jokes with the audience and like just being very lighthearted with it, which was really refreshing, as opposed to like the sort of sanitized corporate stuff you see at like an LCS or an ASO race. Yeah, it was great. In terms of like what I wasn't racing, but I've got an article, like a big feature on like sort of our time there, which people will be able to read to sort of get more of a feel of what it was. And also shot a lot of video while we're over there. So in the coming weeks, I'm going to try and sort of glue together the bits of very amateur video that I recorded and little interviews with people, which should also give you a feel for it. And I think I would recommend, you know, people go on holiday to like the Tour or the Giro or whatever, or the classics. But a holiday around Ireland, especially if you get the weather like we had last week, where you could go to the main cities, but then also off the beaten path to where the stages start and finished, I would highly recommend it. And then you can also go to the service stations.
Get yourself some Korean chicken or whatever it was. I think that the important point here is that these, like, part of the reason why when you two were like, hey, can we go to the Ross for a week to call that work? Like, the reason why the answer was an easy yes is that these are themes that exist sort of and underpin all of cycling and all of bike racing, I should say, particularly road racing, is that, like, yeah, the Ross is incredible, but it's not entirely unique. And that'll, I think a lot of parts of the world have something, maybe not quite at the same scale, but something similar where, you know, there's the place where everybody who does this weird sport gets together, and you see everybody, you know, once a year, twice a year, whatever it is. And that underpins kind of the whole community and in some ways the whole sport. Like, you wouldn't end up, there has to be a pipeline to the Tour de France, right? Like, there has to be ways for athletes to get there. And events like this, where the majority of people you run into are volunteering, and, you know, which is very different from at the Tour de France, where every single person you interact with is getting paid to be there, right? That means a lot, and that changes the way that that these events feel, I think. And they're hugely, hugely important to the sport as a whole, and don't tend to get a whole lot of sort of broader coverage. So we love it.
On it being my final Ross thing that everybody seems to be mentioning there, as far as I'm concerned, it is my final Ross. Like, the actual Ross itself, I could go on, and like, if it was 3 weeks long, I would love every second of it, and I could do that. I could do that forever. Like, that wouldn't be a problem. But everything to get there, and even this year, like, I only did two race days plus 40 minutes of a kermesse in the build up, because it's just the commitment and all that to get ready for it. In the way that I would want to get ready for it, it's just too big when you've got, you know, family and full-time job and all that. And I wouldn't want to be going back at a, you know, the reason I keep going back and the reason I keep getting dragged back is, yes, for that, you know, the atmosphere about it and the buzz and the enjoyment that you get from doing the Ross every year, but also, you know, a big part of it is chasing a stage win, and a stage win just isn't coming for me at this point. Like, that's I can easily admit now that boat has sailed, and I missed the boat. So that's not a big problem. The only slight hesitation that I have in saying it's my last is that, you know, should something like we've often talked about getting a bunch of sort of former cyclists and mates who used to race together to do like one last Ross and sort of enjoy the night stages to their full potential that we maybe didn't get an opportunity to do when we were chasing stage ones. So, you know, no, kind of happen, kind of hoping that doesn't happen. But, you know, say the likes of, you know, Philip Dagenham, and I'm not even going to all the names, but I know that myself and Philip have mentioned enough times that if he came back and he says, you know what, I've never done a Ross, I want to do one now, that might tempt me to do one more Ross. But as far as I'm concerned, for actually taking the Ross as seriously as I feel it should be taken, I think I should quit now while I'm ahead, because, you know, to get a foil cycling club and a team into the Ross for the first time, for that team to then go and get someone in the top 10 in GC, to win the final stage, to stand on the podium with my daughter in a foil jersey as best team, county team in the race, I don't think I'm going to get a better full stop than that. And if I try to prolong it anymore, it might just be like a slow decline that nobody wants to see. So I haven't actually publicly mentioned that or anything, because I was going to do a retirement announcement, but then somebody else stole my thunder there in the Giro, and we know how much I love talking about Mark Cavendish. So if we must move on and we must talk about retirements, probably better we focus on his.
Can I just say, before we do talk Giro, I appreciate how obvious it is. And how kind of open you are, Ronan, with like how important this race is to you. I love it. Like, I genuinely, genuinely love it. And I think to sort of like draw lines from this particular event out, that's true. Like, that sentiment that you have towards this race is the reason why bike racing still exists across the world, right? That multiplied times thousands and thousands of people who feel the same way about their local bike race. And I say local, national, whatever. The scale is irrelevant. You know what I mean? Like the race that is your community. Anyway, I absolutely love it. So,
if you really care, for the next half an hour, you'll say the Italian Ross rather than saying the Giro.
Let's talk about the Italian Ross.
For the riders from Foil CC, give it up for the riders from Foil CC, Ronan McLaughlin, John O'Carrigan, Phil Crockett, and Joseph Laverick. Well done, Foil CC.
Well, we had a bunch of other news this week. So we do want to talk Cav. We want to talk Giro. Do we want Vodders and Lance Armstrong yelling at each other on Twitter? I mean, that's funny.
Maybe.
Like, we'll touch on it later in the show. Let's kick off with sort of the big obvious news from the week, which is that Mark Cavendish announced at a rest day press conference on Monday that he is going to be done. This is his last year. We've talked extensively about Cav in the last couple months on this podcast, and I don't feel like we can say a whole lot that hasn't been said, to be honest. But yeah, what, your reactions to this? I mean, not surprising, right?
No, I guess not. I mean, you hear like rumors and things to the grapevine that the only reason he carried on this year was because he put like a contract offer out there for however much money, and if any team wanted to take him up on it, then he'd race for them, and that's what Astana did, and maybe that wasn't that expected, but you know, I guess it's a nice bonus year. He announced it at a press conference on the rest day, surrounded by his family who'd flown out because it was his birthday before as well. And what I heard from a colleague on the ground was the benefit of that was that because he was sitting alongside his children, when he was asked like sort of questions about 35 tour stage wins, he couldn't actually tell any of the reporters to fuck off, which was, you know, that's a silver lining. But yeah, I mean,
so we need all pros to bring their children to all press conferences so that they can behave. Is that
I like
that
idea.
Well, I would say more that then like reporters can sort of take the mick a bit and ask the questions maybe they would have got shouted at for anyway. But yeah, I mean, look, Cav is Cav. Maybe like I think with cycling fans, there's maybe more. Maybe it's quite like a media behind the scenes view that like he's sometimes kind of terrible, and that's maybe not reflected when he's like winning sprints in amazing fashion or his like public facing persona. But there are like he's a complex individual, and it will, despite what you think of him, it will be sad, I guess, when he leaves and he's not around anymore, because he is. I mean. He's a huge part of the sport and a huge character and just intriguing. I mean, I don't think Ronan probably feels the same, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's when now he's out, it's like, oh, you don't need to keep like poking fun, but like making like light, like joking about him at Astana and stuff like that. Like now it's like you let him kind of sail off into the sunset having. He's like now ran out of all the expletives he can throw your way, you know.
I think he, you know, it goes without saying that, you know, the huge impact that he's had, not just on this, you know, on the sport of cycling, but actually on the discipline, for lack of a better term, of sprinting. You know, he has pretty much changed how sprinters sprint, for, you know, to put it obviously, but also just how they conduct themselves, how a sprint unfolds. It's probably hard to, or impossible to disentangle him, but he has also had some influence on all the sort of aerodynamics that we've seen in cycling of late, because he came along, didn't have the huge watts that other sprinters had, but because he could make himself so aerodynamic, had huge amounts of success. And, you know, every other shape and size of sprinter going have tried to replicate that since. You know, he changed how lead out trains work. He then changed himself to work without a lead out train. Obviously his success has been phenomenal. I think the new low point though of his career was that announcement, because it was whoever scripted that for him needs to have a serious word with themselves. That was very poorly worded. It was sort of read even worse, and the fact that someone put in there that he's enjoyed every kilometer of that Giro, surely that has to be, like, that's, if it was in the confessional boxes, he'd be getting 10 Hail Marys for coming out with that one. Like, there's no way everybody has, anybody has enjoyed every kilometer of this Giro so far. It's been impossible to enjoy watching it, never mind enjoy riding through so much rain and dull, boring stages. And he's crashed. Like, you cannot tell me he enjoyed the last kilometer of that stage that he crashed on. Like, it's, yeah, so...
It was kind of, it didn't live up to the moment of him like just reading that statement off an iPad, you know. It was like, that's not how you call time on like one of the, you know, best careers of a professional cyclist ever. It was just like him just sort of with his Monster Energy hat on trying to read this garbled statement off an iPad. It's like, I expected more, like, I don't know, you're in Italy, like make it like, can there not be a fountain, like, at least like have the fountain like spurting the Monster Energy drink out over, like cascading over your head or something. Come on.
I thought, you know, given that it's Astana, they could have done like the only lead out they possibly could deliver for Cav this year would have been had each rider just lined up in front of him and done some sort of unveil where they each step away to the side from and leave Cav standing at the end with some sort of I'm out of here poster or something. Joking aside, I don't think this is the last we're going to see of Mark Cavendish, so I can see him moving into, you know, TV punditry, or just based on the fact that, you know, anytime he has missed the Tour de France, he goes straight onto TV and commentates on that edition of the race. So I dare say this isn't the last we've seen of him. Based on reading from that iPad, let's hope he's not like a news anchor or something, but I do see him sticking around the sport for quite a bit to come, just not as a rider, obviously.
I can already see him in the GCN crew neck sweater on the big 100%. On the big like virtual reality like sprint thing, and he's like doing the thing where he squints his eyes and moves his head when he's like trying to explain something, and you know, when all the Americans like use their VPNs to watch the GCN coverage, they're not going to understand what he's saying, and we're going to get a whole new chapter to Mark Cavendish.
It's a sprint heavy team if he does go to GCN, because you'll then have Robbie, Adam Blythe and Cav all dissecting the one sprint. You know, Cav has by far and away the richest Palmares, we'll put it that way, will surely be number one in that sprint train. The other two guys might have to lead him out. I'm not sure how they'll take to that.
Do you think that like he says to other journalists when they ask him questions, do you reckon at any point he'll say to all of that was a shit question? We have to see. You know, that would be something worth watching for.
I can't wait for this. I think there's 100% chance he ends up on television, probably almost immediately, next year. I don't even think he takes a year off. I don't know. Starts a podcast. Like who knows what he's gonna do. I do think like we're kind of I don't know, taking the Mickey out of him here. He is the greatest sprinter of all time. I think that's worth saying out loud. I think a lot of the greatest athletes in their particular area have other faults, in the same way that we all have faults, regardless of how good or bad we might be at our jobs. And I think that's very true of Mark Cavendish, is that, he's a you know, perhaps as media, we saw those faults slightly closer up than a lot of our audience out there. And so we tend to dwell on them a little bit more than perhaps we maybe should.
Yeah, definitely.
If you stuck me in front of a camera as often as Mark Cavendish has been in front of a camera, I would probably have also told some people to fuck off by now. So I give him some leeway there. But for me, it's the same, the sort of the personality traits that made him so spiky with us sometimes is also the personality trait that probably made him the best sprinter of all time. So I don't think you can actually dissociate those two things. And to be honest, it's also the personality traits that are going to make him a very good pundit. So I'm kind of looking forward to his next step here.
Yeah, it sort of, and it was my fault, it descended into sort of a laugh there for a bit. And that's, you know, there was a lot of nods of head nodding in approval to what you were saying there, Kitty, from both myself and Johnny. You know, there is no doubt he is the greatest sprinter that the sport has ever seen. Yes, there will be, you know, people will have all their favorite sprinters or whatever, or might not agree with that. But I think the stats sort of speak for themselves at this point. And, you know, given the generation that the couple of generations at this point that he has sprinted against, and he has come out on top more often than not, because as bike racers you get used to losing quite often no matter how good you are, but he has come out on top of sprints, or at least been the strong favorite for sprints more often than any other sprinter throughout the couple of different generations that he's gone up against.
He has 161 pro wins,
and he might get another one at the end of this Giro stage.
Yeah.
The 161 pro wins thing, like that's, I do think we should not caveat that at all, but actually just reinforce how impressive that is. You know, when you compare it to the likes of Eddie Merckx or something, yes, it's not in the same league, but
different eras.
Different eras. That's one thing. But what I want to sort of stress is a different type of rider that they are also, and just how dominant Cav was when you compare him to other sprinters, especially the sort of generation of sprinters we have now, and there's a whole load of reasons for it, but there's probably very, very few of them who are going to, you know, even reach triple figures for sprint victories, never mind be almost, you know, be well above 150 on their way to, you know, he may well finish out the season. By the time he retires, a couple more wins, he could be looking at 165 pro wins, and in an era where the sprinters nowadays, the likes of Ewan and Bennett and whoever else there is there, Greipel beforehand, where sprinters now struggle to take home more than one victory from a Grand Tour, and one sprint victory at a Grand Tour is seen as a success. Let's remind yourself that Cav has on multiple occasions come away from the Tour de France with 4, 5, 6 stage victories. And that's just the kind of dominance that we probably will never see again.
Well, is he going to win one? Is he going to win a Tour de France stage?
Probably. Maybe. Well, Van Aert said the other day he's not going to be approaching the tour in the same way, is he? So maybe he... I can't remember if that means that he'll be going just for green and stage.
I think because it starts in Bilbao this year and not Copenhagen, so he's heading southwest instead of northeast.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Jesus Christ.
I'm still getting over him, that cutout of him in Belgium doing the Red Bull advertisement.
Flapping his arms. Flap.
We talk a lot about ridiculous statements like, but you know, what's he going to do? Just not go for the green jersey, having won it last year? Yeah. Right, whatever.
Yeah. No, I think he's probably going to go for it. I think Cav will probably win one. He's like, I will say that like yeah, as a spiky individual, he's not like my favorite person to interview. He's not my favorite rider. I'm not necessarily a fan as much as I respect what he's done, but I still want him to win it.
Yeah, there is something about a Cav win that just kind of hits different, isn't there?
Yeah, like, you know. Yeah. I think he's also like, and we don't want to spend too much more time on this, but he's a bit emblematic. Like him and essentially Geraint Thomas are like the last two that are left of this like emblematic British period, right? Where, you know, win your first Tour de France, you know, London Olympics, Sky, that whole sort of decade was defined for the first time ever by British cyclists. And he, with his retirement and then probably soon Geraint Thomas's retirement, then that generation is basically then done. And there doesn't appear to be much kind of coming up behind with the same ability to sort of like grab the imagination of the British public. And maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't live there. Like, you know, Pidcock does not seem to grab the imagination in the same way as Cav did or as Wiggins did. You had this like incredible combination of superb athletes and kind of, you know, best in class athletes.
And the Olympics,
And the Olympics with really fascinating personalities, right? Like guys who were willing to speak their mind, who were willing to be a human being outside of the bike race. And I'm mostly talking about Cav and Wiggins here, and that's now going to be, I'm going to close the door on that one. So I think that's a shame for British cycling. It's just a shame for cycling. Like, you know, we're journalists. We like stories, and those guys were always good for a story. Every time they did anything, they were good for a story.
If we are going to see him move into TV though, just to finish up on Cav here, if we are going to see him move into a role like that, I think he should have to do like an apprenticeship or something where he has to do like a full season on the ground interviewing riders on the other side of the camera. It's almost like a purgatory or something before he moves on into front the camera TV work, you know, just to get a taste of that, what it's like to be on the other side.
I want to see him sweating out at the presidential tour of Turkey and then having to hot foot it up to like the Arctic race of Norway and like asking people how their legs are.
I think the end of that could be the day that he has to interview Mads Pedersen. Those two facing up to each other.
That's
TV gold.
It's like switching the Large Hadron Collider on, isn't it? Crikey. Let's talk about let's talk about the other personalities at the top of the Giro GC who were inundating us with quotes about their stage yesterday. Wasn't exactly
It took a while for the Giro to actually kind of kick off here, and I think there's a number of reasons behind that. That there's been plenty of chatter about the quote-unquote boring Giro. I don't think we disagree with most of that. I also don't think it's really worth us. Johnny loved this Giro, mostly because you were at the Ross. But the
true.
I don't think it's worth us like diving into. Let's not talk about the boring Giro.
It's more boring than the boring Giro.
I don't think it's been boring at all. But I haven't been watching it, so.
There you go. So there's exactly my point. Let's talk about a good stage. The first mountain stage, and in particular, João Almeida riding in a way that we haven't really seen him ride much before. He's wow, maybe he's just never quite been strong enough to do what he did. But he was the one that kind of took the race by the horns. It looked like Roglic and Thomas were just kind of eye each other up as long as they possibly could. Turns out, perhaps, that Roglic wasn't feeling all that great. I think that's what we saw when he was ended up being distanced and lost, 29 seconds? But yeah, we have Joao Almeida to thank, I think, for the first kind of spicy GC stage of this Giro d'Italia.
Yeah, it was like almost like a transformation yesterday. I did catch yesterday's stage, and Joao Almeida just started off setting a tempo and looked like this could be just another slog fest, and you know, who knows what might have happened there. But he then pulled off the front, went back into the group, and launched a proper attack, the likes of which we unfortunately don't see all that often when it's a group of riders like that who, you know, nobody really knows who is the clear favorite there. And you know, regardless of whether that was because he was strong enough to do it yesterday and hasn't been strong enough in the past, or because he has more confidence or whatever it is, to be in that position and then to make an attack like that are easier said than done. You know, he was already standing to move up considerably in the GC there before he made that move, and still he made the move to sort of even further move up in GC and improve his position even further. You know, it would have been very, very easy there just to play the safer game, have a look around, say, well, I'm probably going to beat Eddie Dunbar in the time trial. I don't know how good Thomas and Roglic are. Let's just first of all secure third place here today and then think about perhaps moving up later in the week, because you know, the rest of this final week is extremely difficult also. But thankfully he sort of laid it on the line there, and then it seemed to be that Thomas quickly realized Roglic wasn't in the condition maybe that he would hope to be, and jumped across in a similar fashion, and yeah, it was sort of the two of them from there.
Yeah, and if you don't try, you'll never know. And I think that's the thing, is that there was a danger there of no one trying and us never knowing. And frankly, like Thomas never knowing that Roglic was on a bit of an off day, right? If you don't try, you never know. So I appreciated Almeida kind of giving it a bit of a go there. I do wonder. I wonder what's up with Roglic this Giro. He just doesn't quite look.
Who knows?
Like he's yeah.
Because then he's back in the bunch today, and he was like joking with the TV camera. So maybe, but I don't know.
Maybe he seems like he's in a good place mentally. I mean, that yeah, even remember yeah. like after the time trial where we all were kind of like, that's not an amazing, like it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't an amazing ride for him. He lost a bit of time to Remco, and he was like the more chipper than I've ever seen him, which is unusual. Yeah,
he's like reached Zen or whatever it's called. Like he's reached Nirvana. He's just like, well, you know, I'm kinda. Pretty good, but if I don't win, then it doesn't really matter, does it? Like,
it does feel like that, doesn't it?
It does feel like that, but I also kind of think that Roglic is just perhaps supremely confident in how well the closing stages of this final week are going to go for him, and especially that mountain time trial. I think he is still as good a time trialist as he's always been. It's just that the time trialing game has moved on, and as flat as his back is, I don't think Roglic is anywhere near as aero as. That's maybe the wrong way to put it. A better way maybe to put it is that Roglic doesn't have the watts to CDA that the likes of a Venepoel or a Ganna that they have. And as such, in the opening time trial, especially where the speeds were so high, he was always standing to lose time. But flip forward to the mountain time trial later this week, that is, you know, immeasurably less important, and being a good time trialist and being a good climber is going to be much more important. As we speak here today, he's at 29 seconds down. If he has maybe looked at previous Grand Tours where he hasn't, I'm not talking about plans to Belfi before they say this, but let's just chat in general. Roglic seems to struggle towards the end. Not struggle, but it definitely doesn't seem to be, the final days of a Grand Tour don't seem to be his best. If he's sort of addressed that and is planning to be much better towards the end of this week, at 29 seconds back, this regardless of which way it goes, I guarantee there's not 29 seconds between Roglic and either second place or first place by the end of this race.
What's also fun is that the sort of narrative or storyline for any of those top three winning the Giro is quite fun. Like, you have Thomas going back to like win his second Grand Tour. You have Roglic finally winning a Grand Tour that's not the Vuelta. And then you have João Almeida winning his first Grand Tour. So I think it's going to, whatever happens, there's going to be a nice, neat little bow tied on the end of this Giro by the end of it.
Yeah. And the Giro has, again, we're not going to talk about the boring Giro stages thing, but they have backloaded their routes for a number of years. And I think actually part of the reason why we all kind of forget what last year's Giro was like, because the last few stages are always quite good. And I think the same thing's going to happen this year, where the last week is actually going to be quite good. And we will just completely forget about the sort of middle week where we weren't doing much at all watching the Giro.
Andy McGraw was chatting to us yesterday and saying, like, would people prefer it if like Evenepoel was like 3 or 4 minutes up on GC and that the race was over? It's like, you can't, I don't know, yeah, what do people expect? But going in with three final stages where they're all gonna be blockbuster and no one knows what's gonna happen, I mean, come on.
I am gonna have to pop off the podcast here. I have to go and get a bus to get home, but before I do, and I'll leave you guys to finish off the Italian Ross part of the podcast here. A mention for Eddie Dunbar, who I've seen a stat somewhere yesterday. Hard to believe this is his second Grand Tour. Feels like he's been around for ages. Feels like he's done countless Grand Tours at this point. But apparently, if that stat is correct, this is his second Grand Tour. And I should really know that, but I just find it that hard to believe. I can't really confidently say it. Either way, he was there yesterday in that finale with the three favorites for this race. As someone put it to me this morning, it was a fine day for Cork cycling, because you've got Eddie Dunbar from Cork in the top five in GC. You've got Ben Healy, whose grandparents hail from County Cork as well, in the mountains jersey. You've got the winner of the Ross coming from County Cork as well. So Sunday and Tuesday all round were just fabulous days for County Cork.
Congrats to everybody out there in County Cork. Superb days for you. Ronan, go get your bus.
Thanks, folks.
We'll see Ronan again next week, probably. Well, I think I think that's Giro for us.
Yeah.
Johnny?
Yeah, and usually right. Corks and the Giro don't go that well together, so that's kind of nice that they've managed to flip the script.
All right, Ronan, get out of here.
Bringing any puns.
I just took a while.
Bye-bye.
I backloaded my puns in this podcast, much like the Giro's mountain stages.
All right.
See ya.
Travel safe. See ya. All right, Johnny, it's just the two of us. Does that mean we shift into talking about Lance Armstrong and Jonathan Botters and Thibaut Pinot and Twitter? Which is now Twitter already is a cesspool, more of a cesspool now than it's ever been. And frankly, this is the best thing I've seen on it in quite some time.
Yeah, and I don't think Ron actually had to get his bus. He didn't want to talk about this topic. But I think I was getting on the ferry back to Britain, and I saw it like pop up on Twitter, and I was like, is this like a thing that Musk has messed up? And there's all these tweets being threaded together like incorrectly. It was Jonathan Vaught who kicked it all off, which I guess is the most likely scenario of this. So it was when Vaughters tweeted to say how nice it was that Ben Healy had congratulated Brandon McNulty on the stage 15 win after Ben Healy finished second, referencing the fact that when Thibaut Pinot finished second a few days ago, he'd quote unquote been crying about the fact that Jefferson Cepeda had been a thorn in his side all day and not working and stuff like that. And Thibaut Pinot, thorn in the side, is just the perfect phrase. But then what was even better is that someone then tweeted back at Vaughters being like, why don't you just at Thibaut Pinot if you're going to sort of call him out on this? So then Jonathan Vaughters did do exactly that, to which Thibaut Pinot replied, who are you?
Which is just fantastic.
Which is, do you think he got help? Do you think someone told him that was the thing to reply? Like the best put down?
I think his English is okay. And, you know, maybe picks up on the meme vibes. I don't know.
He just doesn't feel like a very online cyclist to me. I can't imagine him.
No, he has goats.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
People with goats are not usually particularly online.
But yeah, that was great. And then when you thought it couldn't get any better, the winner of the 1998 Tour of Luxembourg chimes in. A fellow you might like, you probably haven't heard of him. He's called Lance Armstrong. He didn't really do much else after that. And he sees this as his. He's got a big beef with Jonathan Walters over various things, which are, yeah. And Lance Armstrong sees this as his point to sort of try and gain Thibaut Pinot as an ally against his hatred of Jonathan Walters, being like, right, can you believe this guy? Like, oh, don't worry about him, he's just a clown. That was amazing. And then over the top, right at the last second, comes Pro Cycling Stats, who within this group, this already like triplet of people, they sort of are in the middle of sort of like how questionable they are with their like their various vibe or whatever, saying like, oh guys, can't we all just play along and be nice to each other? But then go on to start quoting Mahatma Gandhi and Anne Frank in other replies to people being like, why are you getting involved? So it was just like, it was like everyone sort of forgot how to interact. It was like very sort of 2013 Twitter, but in 2023, like everyone sort of time traveled back 10 years. And it was great. I enjoyed it.
If you're not on Twitter, you probably don't really understand, I don't know, some of the details of this, but like, and we refuse to write a story about it, I think, but the funny thing to me is that it's just the grudges that continue.
Yeah.
You know, like the fact that we've got one, that Jonathan Waters would kind of like, reference Pinot without saying his name. That part was funny. Pinot responding with a like sort of thoroughly online response, kind of dissing him back, was funny. And then Lance Armstrong coming in over the top of all of it, and like you said, using it as an opportunity to pull Thibaut Pinot on side, extra funny. But then you get the JV Lance Armstrong thing, and they were going back and forth for like days.
Yeah.
Afterward, where they would just sort of snipe at each other, and it's a reminder. So, like, you know, back in sort of the earlier days of my reporting career was very much like those two were at each other all the time, right? It was for me, it was very much of a bit of a throwback and a reminder of how, you know, like I think Lance and like George Hincapie and that crew have kind of just sequestered themselves off to the side, you know. They run We Do camps. There's like a one in Mallorca next fall that Lance is currently shouting about on Instagram. You know, they cost like $50,000 a head or something ridiculous. They just got their own little, you know, they got their own little racket going, right? Yeah. And then on the other side of it, you've got JV, who's run this team for a very long time. You could argue like has his own little racket going. And they haven't actually had to interact with each other all that much in the last couple of years. And so, yeah, this whole spat was just a good reminder that, like, they hate each other. They really genuinely hate each other. And there's a lot of subtext around everything that they're writing. And in particular, like Vodder's sort of coming back and he, like, did this tweet explaining basically that, like, Armstrong had the opportunity to speak to USADA back in the day and to possibly, this is as reported, possibly keep his tour if he had done so, that's been reported previously. And I don't know how true that is. I think that you'd have to get inside, inside USADA and get some emails and things like that to find out if that's actually correct. And I think Lance probably would say that is incorrect, but that is the suggestion. And certainly everybody who did go and talk to USADA in that era was treated, you know, quite nicely, right? Like very short bans or no ban at all. You know, I'm talking about Hincapie, Vandevelde, that sort of American crew. And so, yeah, just to watch this thing go back and forth and back and forth and kind of pull back a spat that really had laid dormant for a decade and put it back on Twitter was highly enjoyable for me.
I this is a personal opinion, but I deeply respect people who can hold a grudge for so long with bringing that same level of like animosity that they've probably still felt when it was all going on at the time. It's great.
Here's the irony of it all. This is two guys, and they are very different personalities, and one of them I certainly get along with a lot better than I get along with the other one.
Lance,
Yeah, I just love Lance. Love him. No, but it's two guys who fundamentally are both now sitting on fairly large sums of money. Lance more than Vaughters. Have found significant success in careers in this space. And you could very much argue both did that on the back of the same thing. Right? And so to have them then argue with each other over who did that worse is funny to me. Because both of them, I think probably both of them would admit this, that like, I mean, well, I know the Vaughters have said this out loud, you know, lots of mistakes were made, things like that. But the irony of these two in particular, who effectively have made careers off the same mistakes, the same lies, the same, et cetera, I think that that is, it's just ironic. And just from pure entertainment factor, I think I can enjoy that.
Are you trying to get us uninvited from the EF post Tour de France boat party this year, Kaylee? Because as much as I stand for, you know, journalistic independence and all the things that the Escape Collective is, I also really, really enjoyed the boat party last year. So I just want to put it out there that that is the price of my independence, and I did not say the things that Kaylee said. Nah, JV will be fine with that. He didn't, you know, he probably agrees with you to some extent.
I think JV would agree with me. Yeah. How can you not agree with me?
Yeah.
Like they both did the same things. One is definitely more contrite than the other. One has apologized more profusely. One has, one has essentially, you know, built a bike racing team, ostensibly built off of clean racing, and you could view that as a sort of penance for Jonathan Vaughters. I think it's like that was his response to doing something terrible. But I think, if you take it all the way back to its original state, like the reason why we know both of these names is the same reason, right? And so that for me is the great irony of it. And and I don't think either of them could really push back on that, to be perfectly honest. And further, my sort of last point on this, while it was entertaining to watch this 2012 grudge match come back, 2011, 2013, I'm trying to remember, yeah, it was all around there.
Yeah.
It was the very, very beginning of my reporting career, so it's very, very sort of nostalgic for me. While all that was happening, it also occurred to me that I don't think we're going to have similar things coming out of the current generation of bike racers. And I think that that is also worth just noting and maybe appreciating. We miss out on some of the entertainment value, but I don't think we're going to have... who would be two good examples? I don't think we're going to have a Matteo Jorgensen, Brandon McNulty beef 10 years from now on Twitter. I just don't think we're gonna have it. Maybe I could be wrong. Maybe Matteo loves a good beef. I don't know. But that's worth kind of appreciating as well. It's kind of an indication of how far the sport has come.
Look, and the thing is, things could always be worse for sort of everyone wrapped up in that, because you could be Patrick Lefevre liking tweets containing pornographic material and not realizing that everyone can see it. But we will not go into that because we don't need to. No one needs to have that back in their mind's eye.
Yeah. The only small amount of context is basically anything you like on Twitter, and this is a public service announcement, anything you like on Twitter, everyone else can see a list of the things you have liked on Twitter. And so pay attention to the things you like on Twitter and try your absolute best to not like pornographic videos on Twitter.
Yeah.
I think that is that's the public service announcement for all of our listeners out there.
It's a public service announcement for like for 2012, 2013, the era we were just talking about when people were still learning how to use Twitter. But Patrick's just been there for 10 years not knowing that. But yeah, I think we've covered every possible topic now in range.
That's the end of this week's Placeholder Podcast. Thank you everybody for listening. As a reminder, this podcast is funded entirely by members of Escape Collective. So head over to escapecollective.com and sign up if you haven't already.
Yeah, it's how we keep this whole thing alive. And if enough of you don't, then we will disappear. So if you like this pod, make sure you go sign up, and we appreciate it. Keep an eye out for a pretty serious bike racing podcast from the Giro this weekend. We got Wheel Talk coming up. There's Thurgan and a couple other races going on right now. I've got a geek warning next week. Make sure you listen to all the pods. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.